All right. Today is Wednesday, April 29th, 2015, and I call to order the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Wow. Nobody noticed. John noticed that. To make sure everyone who's here is awake. We have several people who are going to be running a little bit late today, but we're going to start anyway. And I believe that Rep. Evans is excused and is not going to be able to be in attendance at all today. So we will open a public hearing on House Bill or Senate Bill 225A. And can we please have a summary of the bill?
Sure. Vice Chair Stark, members of the committee, Senate Bill 225A allows Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority to notify benefit recipients of suspension or closure of Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, otherwise known as SNAP, and the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, otherwise known as WIC, through news media information at sites recipients frequent and general mailings to recipients' households, declares emergency effective on passage. Because this is a Senate bill, the paperwork has been issued. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. There is no subsequent referral. It did come to us from the Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood with unanimous support.
All right, thank you. I'd like to call Bleet Burke from the Department of Human Services and John Mullen with Oregon Law Center, if you guys will come and share with us. Did I say your name right?
You did.
Thank you. Thank you. You got it right.
Thanks.
It's a trend with this committee. Name is pronounced right every time.
Excellent.
Shocking.
It's all about the staff.
Good afternoon. That's my name, for the record, is Bleet Burke. I am the Supplemental Assistance a Nutrition Assistance Program Manager for Department of Human Services, and I'm just going to give a brief overview of the program. So the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, as of March, was serving over 700,000 Oregonians. Nearly 36% of the participants are children. 50% of the participants are between the ages of 18 and 59. Seniors are our fastest-growing population. And 30% of SNAP participants are employed but not earning enough money to lose eligibility. And the purpose of this program is really to provide a nutritious supplement to someone's income, or if they're not, if they have no income, really to try to help them with their nutrition needs and provide them with a food benefit. The program was set up by the federal government. It's to expand and contract dependent upon the economy. So when we had the economic downturn, we really saw our caseload grow, and it's starting to decline now. But it's declining slowly just because folks aren't really getting, high-wage jobs and full-time employment. And people receive their benefit through the Oregon Trail Card. And the benefits can only be used for USDA-approved items, and those are set by Congress. The state doesn't have a say in what people can and can't purchase on SNAP benefits. 89% of our caseload is on or under 30% of federal poverty level and have an average benefit amount of $236. So that's, the majority of our caseload is really at or, at or under 130% of federal poverty level. We do go up to 185% in this state at federal poverty level and allow people to come on, but under 1% of the caseload is at 185% of federal poverty level, and the average benefit for that group is $113. And so that's a quick overview. Are there any questions?
That's an overview of
the program.
Of the program. But the bill itself.
So the bill itself, I can talk about that too, although I was asked just to talk about the program. So the reason why we had brought forward or had wanted to support this bill was due to a federal shutdown that we had had a few years back. And during this federal shutdown, we, it didn't actually happen, but we were asked to prepare and follow our state statutes, which required us to notify every participant by mail that the program would potentially be going away, or we were to let them know that they were going to lose the program, is really what the letter was saying, because we didn't know day by day, whether or not we were going to have to mail out those notices. We were having a lot of conversations with our federal partners from FNS, and they were asking us not to notify the population. They did not want us to do that because they thought we would cause other states to have problems with hysteria and people being worried that they were losing their benefits and that kind of thing, and they wanted us to wait. So with the state statute requiring the 10-day notification to all participants, you know, we really were having these conversations to the midnight hour. We ended up pricing and getting everything ready except for the postage to be paid to send these out. So we had everything printed and ready to go, and we're waiting at the midnight hour to hit send and have them go. And so really this just gives us the opportunity to be able to, if we have to give this kind of notification as a state, do it with all the rest of the states rather than us being out there by ourselves and notifying folks. During the same time frame, Washington State had their WIC program had notified folks, and so that had caused a little bit of problems within our state where people were panicking and afraid that they were going to lose their benefits as well. And so really this just helps us align and stay together state by state so that we don't cause problems in other people's states and we don't scare people if we don't need to.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I want to just use this bill as an illustration of the work we sometimes do with Department of Human Services. Jill Gray and Liesl Wen, at that time, who was the self-sufficiency manager, came to the Human Services Coalition and explained the problem the way Belit did about when we have a potential for a government shutdown and all of the expense and the confusion and the concern that this would cause to people. And we listened to the discussion and said, yeah, we really agree with this. This is okay. When the bill itself came out of legislative council, it not only talked about these issues about a mass shutdown of the federal government, but it also had a word in there about reducing benefits. And I raised some concerns about that word being in there because, in fact, there have been instances when food stamp SNAP benefits have been reduced, like, for example, when they were increased with the stimulus dollars and then they were reduced later on. So we wanted to make sure that people did get proper notice if their benefits were going to be reduced on an ongoing basis, but not when there was this discussion that goes on where there's a government shutdown or issues relating to getting the program reauthorized. Even in reauthorization times, they usually provide the spending even if they haven't reauthorized the bill. So we had a very good discussion with DHS. They were in total agreement about removing essentially one word from the bill on the Senate side. We got the bill amended and passed and over here. So I just really want to say that it's just an illustration about when issues are a concern to clients and there are issues of notice and there are issues of benefits. In almost every instance, we have the department has an enlightened view of trying to make sure that they do the best by the people in terms of making sure that the benefits are secure, but also making sure that people have adequate notice. So this bill in and of itself really is a good idea for those things that happen at the federal government that may really be more of a political nature than really something that's actually going to lead to a reduction in benefits. So we support the bill as amended.
Any questions? And so just to verify, so this is our normal notifications all stay the same. This is for the very rare occasion when we're looking at something like a total federal shutdown kind of deal. And just saying that when we're put on notice that something like that might happen, we don't need to spend $150,000 to make this notification. If that's what I'm understanding?
Vice Chair Starr, that is correct.
All right. Excellent. Oh, we do have a question down here.
Filling in Chair Stark. Thank you. Under the SNAP program, my understanding of the federal requirements are that there is flexibility of what those services, what those dollars can be used to purchase. One of the things I'm interested in doing is hopefully getting enough support someday to work with a waiver. Require a waiver from the federal program, but to be able, for example, buy toothbrushes with that money. My understanding of that is possible. Is that an incorrect understanding? But it is difficult.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, Representative Hayden, that is incorrect. We have not been able to get any kind. There have not been any waivers that we know of nationally that have allowed anything but the food purchases. If you states can apply for waivers, use state dollars. We can put state dollars on the benefit card to do other things with them. As long as a state is funding the creative things that they want to do, the feds generally will support it.
Okay.
Are there other questions? Excellent. Well, thank you. Is there anybody else who would like to be heard on this bill? All right. Seeing no one, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 225A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 296A. Can we please have a summary of the bill?
Sure. Madam Chair, Vice Chair Stark, members of the committee, Senate Bill 296A transfers administration and funding structure for elderly rental assistance program from Department of Revenue to Oregon Housing and Community Services, prescribes operative dates, takes effect 91st day after sine die. Again, this bill comes to us from the Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood with unanimous support.
Excellent. Thank you. And I have signed up to testify Deanna Mack, Allison McIntosh, and John Mullen, if you guys would like to come up. John, you didn't mark if you were for or against. Do you mind being up here with these ladies? All right. I assumed as much.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. I'm here to talk to you today about our legislative concept, Senate Bill 296, which is asking for you to transfer the elderly rental assistance funding and essentially the program over to the Housing and Community Services Department. First, some background on the current program. Right now, what it does is it allows a payment for to low-income elderly renters. The program has its roots in the homeowner and rental relief program from the 70s. I don't know if you all remember HARP, but it went away in 1991. And the idea of it was to help reduce the property tax burden for these people that had to pay rent, that their landlord was passing the property tax on to them through their rent. So to qualify for assistance, they had to be 58 or older, which evidently in the 70s was elderly, and have a total household income of less than $10,000. Yeah, it has not been indexed. They had to have expenses, among some other things, they had to have some expenses that exceeded 20% of their income. The State General Fund provides the funds to make the ERA payment and appropriation to the Department of Revenue. And you may see in your OLIS materials, there's a chart we provided that talks about the timeline because it kind of is a little bit confusing. But each year, on or before July 1st, people make a claim to the Department of Revenue for the cash assistance for the prior year's expenses that they incurred. We issue a check by November 15th of that claim year. So they start incurring expenses January of, like, for this year's example, 2014 through January of 2015, and we don't refund any of that money to them until November of 2015, so there's quite a long lag in what we do for them. The program eligibility requirements have never been indexed to inflation, and so a steady number of seniors drop out year over year as cost of living COLA adjustments are made to Social Security because they're approaching that $10,000 mark. The program peaked in 1990 with almost just over 11,000 applicants, but today there are less than 2,000 applicants, and we expect that in the next 5 to 7 years, if nothing is done, that this program will just cease to exist because of attrition and the limits being exceeded on income. Right now, Department of Revenue, as you probably know, we're really good at processing tax returns and banking money and auditing that kind of thing, but our mission and our wheelhouse is not in giving housing assistance in any way. And so what we don't do much with these returns other than administrative. We process the returns and we send them their checks. So there's really no oversight to see about the efficacy of the program at all. How we got to this bill was in December of 2010, the governor's recommended budget eliminated the elderly rental assistance program from our budget. And when our budget was presented in the Ways and Means Committee, the funding was restored and a budget note was added that said, no, we don't want you to get rid of this, but instead we want you to study this and we want you to tell us whether there's a better way of dealing with this program. So in February of 2012, we came back to the Ways and Means, to the committee to actually... I don't remember which committee, but we had a report that presented the different options outlining what to do with it. And at the time, the recommendation was to merge it and send it to Housing and Community Services. So legislative concept LC 541 was drafted for the 2013 session, but that concept then was pulled because 2013 housing agency had to go through a major restructure and we didn't know where they were going to land or what was going to happen with them. So we're back with the same recommendation we made in 2012. And the options that we considered and reported in that report, which is available also on OLIS, was to, one, eliminate the program altogether, just to get rid of it, like the governor's recommended budget said in 2010. Expand the program, which would be, you know, you could do more with it, index it to inflation, leave it in its current form and just let it phase out over time, or consolidate the program into similar programs, which is what our recommendation is. Basically, I guess that's where I could let Allison take over, and she can talk to you about how they plan to the consolidation component of this option and go from there.
Sure. Vice Chair Stark, members of the committee, my name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm the Government Relations and Communications Liaison for Oregon Housing and Community Services. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Oregon Housing and Community Services has been working with the Department of Revenue to present a plan for your consideration to transfer the Elderly Rental Assistance Program to OHCS. Discussions to transfer this program were underway when, as Deanna mentioned, in December of 2012, Governor Kitzhaber called on the agency to develop a new model of state governance, service delivery, and community partnership for affordable housing and safety net services. In 2013, OHCS launched an extensive transition planning process that included stakeholders and community partners. In February of 2014, we presented a plan on agency redesign to the legislature and the governor. And then after that, we began discussions with Department of Revenue regarding the Elderly Rental Assistance Program. We revisited the workgroup conclusions, and as Deanna mentioned, we concluded, as they did, that the people in the program might be better served if the program were transitioned to OHCS. We believe that OHCS will be able to integrate this program into existing rental assistance programs and through our partners to better connect seniors currently being served by this program to other forms of assistance. Senate Bill 296 would transfer the program from revenue to OHCS, and it would make changes which we believe would result in better services to seniors with low incomes. OHCS would not continue just to write checks to low-income seniors. Instead, it would be our goal to provide needed rent assistance and other assistance to help keep seniors stable in their homes. The bill would propose to transfer the program into an existing program, the Emergency Housing Account. It's a program that's administered through local community action agencies, and there are community action agencies that serve all 36 counties in Oregon. They provide a range of services designed to help stabilize people and move them out of poverty, including rent assistance, energy assistance, food pantries, and a range of other services from Head Start to job training to senior services. Some of them also have the Area Agency on Aging, or AAA, inside of their agency as well. The Emergency Housing Account program was originally designed to help serve people with low incomes who are at risk of or are experiencing homelessness. The funding goes to help pay rent or help people get back into an apartment. So the bill, as we kind of envision implementing it, would ask seniors who are struggling to pay their rent who have been a part of this program to go visit their local community action agency, and they would be assessed both for needs with rent assistance as well as other things like emergency utility bill assistance, food, and other needs. It is possible, given the amount of funding that some seniors receive from this program, that not everyone would be able to receive rent assistance through this program as we've envisioned it in the future. However, we believe that they might be able to be better assessed to see what needs they actually have and what they could receive assistance with. And right now, we would anticipate that community action agencies would be able to serve between 300 and 500 seniors per $1 million invested in this program, which, given the current level of investment, that would be about 600 to 1,000 seniors per biennium. Should the legislature choose to move forward with Senate Bill 296, we would convene a Rules Advisory Committee that would include Community Action Agency members to fully develop the program rules and look at how the program would be implemented. As Deanna mentioned, there is a document in OLIS which details the pretty long transition timeline. So we're anticipating a long transition timeline to ensure that program participants are really well notified of what's happening and understand where they can go for assistance. If the legislature were to pass Senate Bill 296, the program would transition to HCS starting July 1st of 2017. And that would help ensure that affected seniors are sufficiently aware that assistance would be transitioning to another model. The last applications would be received by Revenue in July 1st of 2016. Seniors would receive their last check from Revenue in November of 2016, and then they would start coming to OHCS for assistance in July. In the meantime, that would give us plenty of opportunities to outreach to these folks who are current program participants and make sure that they receive plenty of notice. There are already three built-in opportunities for them to receive notice, and those are highlighted in purple in the document in OLIS. So the first opportunity would be when they receive the check in November of this year, of 2015, when they receive their application materials in July of 2016, and when they receive their final payment in July or November of 2016. And with that, I'm going to let Deanna wrap up with some details about the bill language and conforming amendments.
So you'll see the bill is fairly lengthy, and sections 9 through 27 are largely conforming language changes. There were several statutes that tied to definitions of household income and income within the Elderly Rental Assistance Program, so we're picking up and moving those definitions into the statutes that need them. So that's basically what those changes are. So they're largely conforming. And section 29 is the operative dates, and it is kind of confusing because and I'll go over that, but paragraph 1 in section 29 repeals the elderly rental program itself, the language for that program, effective January 1 of 2016, but it doesn't take away the administrative provisions for us to be able to process the claims and issue the refunds in 2016. That actually is in paragraph 2 that repeals it on 12/31 of 16 after we've issued our final check, right? And so the new delivery service model that CS will be picking up is going to be in section 3, and that is effective July 1 of 2017. And then paragraph 4 in the operative dates gives the agencies authority to do what we need to do, like the Rules Committee, to implement the change prior to everything actually going into place. And that's kind of graphed out for you on that chart in OLIS. You can kind of see the timeline. With that, if you have any questions for us.
John, did you have testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I first of all want to say that I was a member of the stakeholder group that got together to discuss this idea. I was around during the time that the HARP program had ended, and I have vague recollections of this program as one of the pieces that continued in a different way with providing some rental relief. And it really essentially wound up being pretty much a backwater program for advocate focus because it was handled adequately by the Department of Revenue with sending out the checks. But it really never was a human service program, one where you really could link some of the needs that people had for rental assistance with other kinds of needs. So I supported the direction that we were going in, and then as Allison mentioned, it took a little bit of a detour because of the changes that were in the works for Housing and Community Services. So I think this is a really good thing. My background in running Clackamas County Social Services, we were both a community action agency and an area agency on aging, and it makes sense to think of organizations like the one I formerly was the director of to really then put all of the wraparound kind of services with the people that are very vulnerable. You point out, because this had never been indexed or changed, as was spoken about earlier, that these are really very low-income people, so they almost are down to the minimum level of income that somebody in that age category would get, the SSI level income. So it's really begun to be, as Deanna said, a program that if it stayed the way it is, it would eventually go away because there would be nobody that would wind up qualifying for the program at some point in time. There's just one issue that I have with the bill, and I've talked about this when it was up on the Senate side, and that is the intake process. My view of it is we ought to close intake earlier than July of 2016. In other words, there's no sense in starting some people off with a program that may have a really sort of an inadequate amount of resources to help that person with rental assistance, but instead look at a way of connecting those people that might apply right away with the community action agencies. It's a minor thing. I'm not even suggesting an amendment at this point in time, but I think it's really something that we don't want to continue an expectation if the legislature goes ahead and adopts this bill that this program is going on in perpetuity. So with that, I would just say thank you for the opportunity to testify, and it was a pleasure to work with the Department of Revenue and Housing and Community Services on this.
We have questions?
I have a question. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. So it's right now the program uses about $2 million per year or per biennium?
Madam Chair, it's a biennial number.
So it's about $2 million, and it's covering up somewhere between 600 and 1,000 people.
Madam Chair, it's covering, I think in this year we have, I want to say, around 1,900 applicants. So we get about 1,900 applicants a year, and the refund checks are as small as $12 and as large as, I think, close to 1,000, depending on the amount of rent on the formula that's used. And it is a direct appropriation. If we have more applicants, we have had in the past more applicants than we have money for, and then in that case, around, you know, about 10 years ago, then the income is prorated. But it is a biennial number, and we do know that housing and community services won't be able to serve all of the same population, but we do suspect that many of these people are already getting assistance in some form through them, so we're shifting them over to that agency where we think that they'll be better served.
So that seems clear to me. They'll be better served. You'll see what they have and what they don't have. But when I did the math, I got to about $1,000 versus $1,600 a year in rental assistance just by dividing 600 into 2 million or 300 into a million. So it's
Madam Chair,
not
I can look
money.
At the report. I think that the average, if I can look back at the report that's from 2012, I believe the average refund, that the average, and of course that doesn't really give you a whole lot of information, average, but I believe it was about $300 per person, $367 per renter, and it's a
year.
Per year, and that's an average. And again, the refund checks, there's many of them that are much, much smaller than that, and many of them, several of them that are larger. But it is a $1 million a year assistance program.
Other questions? So I do have one. Would you explain to me just a little bit more detail on the note for those who are on this program that, you know, would be transitioning, the notification process, and really, because it sounds like fewer people, or there are a number of people that will no longer qualify once the transition takes place, what would happen with those individuals? Is there someone more than paper that's just going to them to actually help them transition?
Absolutely, Vice Chair Stark. As we have currently envisioned it, we would include a letter with each of the three mailings that current participants would receive between the time that the legislature makes a decision and the time that the program ends. So that would be the check in November of 2015, the application in July of 2016, and the check in November of 2016. And I think, you know, we haven't talked through what the letter would look like with our community action partners. I would envision that they would have some input into that. But I would assume that it would talk about the program is ending and where they can go in their local community to receive assistance. And as I had said, we do know that we don't believe we'll be able to serve all 2,200 people who are, or 1,900 people that are currently receiving assistance, because I would suspect that someone who makes less than $10,000 a year probably needs more rent assistance than $12. And so it would be my, you know, community action agencies work hard every day to assess people's needs and try to get them the assistance that they can. And so I think the benefit of transferring it to Housing and Community Services and the community action agencies is that we can better assess what they actually need. And maybe instead of rent assistance, they need to be connected to SNAP and energy assistance, because what they're really having trouble with is their electric bill. Or maybe what they really need is a referral to permanent affordable housing, or, you know, and we can work with the community action agencies to assess those needs and get them the help that they need. And it is entirely possible that some people will need a more significant amount of rent assistance, and that we won't be able to provide everyone the rent assistance that they need, because it's a very limited resource. But certainly community action agencies are masterful at piecing together resources and trying to help people the best they can.
So if a senior doesn't read any of these three letters, and therefore they don't attempt to reach out to the agency to qualify for new services, will the agency have the list of everyone that received these letters that they could actually attempt to follow up with and make sure that they actually understand what's going on?
Mr. Vice Chair, the agency, the notices that Allison spoke to are going to be coming from the Department of Revenue, mm-hmm. and they're going to be their checks that they actually get and the forms and instructions that they actually get. So the constraint we have, because we're the taxing authority, is you have some pretty tight disclosure statutes about things that we can share with people. So the unfortunate thing about this is that we can't tell them who we have currently applying for that. Of course, you could amend this bill to allow that if you decide to. That's perfectly within your authority to do that. But right now, we can't do that.
I wonder if I could just comment on that. We really appreciate, from the Oregon Law Center's perspective, about the notice and the fact that the checks would continue until the program ends and shifts and all that. So the question that you raised about notification is really important. I think beyond that, the idea that the program will really be nested in the emergency housing account is going to be a really good place, a permanent home for that particular program. So we continue to be supportive of this, but I think those issues are really important about, you know, folks that might get left out of the equation. I think one of the things that could be something, if not for this session, but maybe in the 2016 session, is doing something that amends on a one-time basis to be able to allow the Department of Revenue to share the addresses with Housing and Community Services. So I don't think it has to slow up the bill this time around, but I think it's an issue that may come up in the work group, the Rules Advisory Group, and there may be recommendations back to the 2016 session about that.
All right. Thanks, John. I trust that you'll follow up on that. Other questions?
Yes, I have a question. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Why not attach that to the bill now, at least give permissive language as opposed to directive language to allow that to happen?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would be interested to see that happen. It's a matter of, you know, knowing that the workload and all the things that are in front of you, if that's acceptable. I would also then, if that's going to have a little bit of discussion, I might also go back to my earlier point about when is the proper time to close intake.
Other questions? All right. Thank you. Is there anybody else in the room? Anybody who wants to testify on this? Well, seeing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 296A. And before we adjourn, do you have announcements?
Well, we have no meeting on Friday or Monday. We don't have a lot of bills coming across yet. So, and we will continue to hold every other Friday for possible sessions, but if we don't have a lot of bills, we will start skipping all Fridays until unless needed.
Right.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. We are.
Comment off the record of this bill, but Monday there will be 3414. Is that the number of it? 3414, which actually may be a future vehicle for things, because it does approve the Oregon Department of Revenue to work with Department of Human Services to spread out payments over a monthly for child care with the intent, if that pilot project works, that we could lead into things like this. So I think that structure is being developed.
That's in the Revenue Committee?
It is in the Revenue Committee on Monday.
Okay, and maybe we'll go hang out there.
Great.
Clearly, Representative Stark, you brought a big crowd today.
They heard I have a gavel, and they all stayed away. We are adjourned.
Nicely done.
We are adjourned.